him in on the progress it had made possible. As he placed the call, he wrestled with the question of how much to reveal, not only about his new view of the fingerprint issue, but about his shifting sense of the whole case. He opted to be fairly open, omitting only his direct contact with Payne. Torres answered on the first ring. How did it go? Smoothly, said Gurney. I hope you didn't run into any problems on your end. None. I just finished relocking the apartment doors. Did you discover anything useful? I think so. If I'm right, it raises some major questions. Like what? Like how sure are you that Payne is the shooter? As sure as I could be without a confession. Sell it to me. Okay, number one, we know he was in the right places at the right times. We have time-coded videos to prove it. Number two, we have his fingerprints on the side door at Poulter Street and on the toilet and fast food wrapper in the Bridge Street apartment. Number three, we have his fingerprints on the cartridge casings found at both shooting sites. We know the prints are his because they match almost all the prints found in his apartment. Number four, a box of .30-06 cartridges with two missing was found hidden under some shirts in his bedroom closet. Number five, we just got a DNA report showing a match between the Band-Aid recovered from the toilet at the Bridge Street apartment and hair follicles recovered from the sink drain in Payne's apartment. Number six, we have a confidential tip from a BDA informant naming him as the shooter. Number seven, his own public statements reveal an obsessive hatred for the police. So there it is. A hate-filled kid aided and abetted by an organization with some hate-filled members. It's a convincing case with a ton of incriminating evidence, a lot more than we usually have. That's part of the problem. The confident tone of Torres's summation dissolved. What do you mean? There does seem to be a ton of evidence, almost too much of it, but no single piece of it is solid. What about the videos? The videos tell us where he was at certain times, they don't tell us why. Wouldn't it be a pretty extreme coincidence if he just happened to be in both those places for some other reason when those shots were fired? Not if someone sent him there. To set him up? It's possible. It would explain why he made no effort to avoid traffic cameras or to obscure his plate number. Gurney could imagine Torres's earnest frown as he considered the implications. But how do you explain the fingerprints? There's an interesting fact about those prints. They're all on portable objects, with one exception, the outside doorknob of the house on Poulter Street. What do you mean by portable objects? Toilets aren't that portable. Right. But the print wasn't on the toilet itself, it was on the flushing lever. Okay, on the lever, so where does that take you? An hour ago it took me from the apartment on Bridge Street to Payne's own apartment. I checked both toilets and took some photos that I'll send you. Photos they show what? That the flushing levers may have been switched. What? It's possible that the flushing lever on the Bridge Street toilet, the one with Payne's prints on it, may have come from his own bathroom. God, if that were true, that would turn everything upside down. Are you suggesting all the evidence was planted? The Band-Aid with Payne's DNA? The cartridge casing with his prints on them? That everything implicating him is part of a giant frame job? Torres's tone was stunned and questioning rather than challenging. The facts are not inconsistent with that scenario. Torres paused. Sounds like I need to get forensics involved again, to take a look at this switched flusher business, but suppose... Jesus. Gurney finished the thought. But suppose the switch was done by someone in the department? Torres said nothing. It's a possibility. So if I were you, I'd keep the flusher issue to myself until we dig a little deeper, and you can be sure you're not discussing it with the wrong person. This case could be a lot nastier than anyone realizes. As he ended the call, the text message sent to John Steele the night he was killed came vividly to mind. Watch your back. Easy night for MFS to ice your ass and blame the BDA. For the next couple of minutes he sat there looking out over the field by the little brick building that housed the restrooms. The local vultures were circling idly on the updrafts from the sun-soaked ground. He decided to call Hardwick and fill him in on the day's events. The man's first words when he picked up were, for him, not unusual. "The fuck do you want now?" Charm, warmth, and a welcoming voice. "You got the wrong number, bro." It was always best with Jack to cut to the chase, so Gurney did so. The ME claims Loomis didn't die from the after effects of the gunshot. Somebody got to him in the hospital with an ice pick. No shit. Bit of a security fuck-up. Any leads? Not that I know of. Inside job, somebody on the hospital staff? Could be. But before we get into that, the ground is shifting under the whole case. It looks like Payne is being... Gurney stopped speaking at the sight in his rearview mirror of a blue Ford Explorer pulling into the rest stop. Hold on a second, Jack. I may be about to have a little trouble with Judd Turlock. Where are you? Deserted rest stop near the Larbiton exit on the interstate. He just drove in behind me. I didn't see him following me. So either he planted a tracker on my car, or he's been having my phone pinged for location. Do me a favor. I'm going to leave my phone on. Keep listening in case I need a witness later. You have your weapon? I do. As he spoke, he removed the Beretta from his ankle holster and tucked it under his right leg, flicking off the safety. If you feel your life is in danger, just shoot the fucker. And that's what I rely on you for. Nuanced advice. As Turlock came to the side of the car, Gurney slipped the live phone in his shirt pocket and rolled down his window. Turlock's voice was expressionless as his eyes. Busy day? Busy enough. You get too busy, you start making stupid mistakes. Gurney met his gaze and waited. Like with that lady back at the hospital. The credentials you showed her said you were from the DA's office, but you're not, not anymore. I could arrest you for impersonating an officer. Maybe let you spend a little time in Sheriff Klotz's hotel. What do you think of that? I think it could create a problem. Actually, two problems. First problem, there's no expiration date on my credentials, and I have a contract that requires written notice of termination, which I never received. Which means the impersonation charge is groundless, so right off the bat, you'd be facing a false arrest charge. Second problem, I heard a rumor that somebody got to Rick Loomis in the ICU. Turlock's eyes seemed to widen just a little. Gurney went on. The security you provided was inadequate, and I told your skirt-chasing officer in front of witnesses that Loomis was in serious danger. That warning was ignored. Now here's the thing, Judd. I have no desire to publicize your major screw-up, but when people get threatened with arrest, they often do destructive things. Who the hell told you somebody got to Loomis? I have informants, just like you and Chief Beckert, except my informants actually know what they're talking about. Something new entered Turlock's eyes, something like the strange calm before a violent storm. Then his gaze fell on the phone in Gurney's shirt pocket, and the strange look was replaced by something more controlled, if no less hostile. You fuck up this murder investigation, Gurney, there's going to be a price to pay. In White River, we consider obstruction of justice a serious crime. Very serious. I couldn't agree with you more. I'm glad we understand each other, said Turlock, staring at him for a long moment with an expression full of stone-cold hatred. He slowly raised his right hand in the shape of a gun, the forefinger pointing at Gurney's face. He dropped the thumb like a hammer. Without another word, he returned to his big blue SUV and drove out of the rest area. Gurney took his phone out of his pocket. You hear all that, Jack? Jesus, was that your idea of nuance? You're lucky the crazy fucker didn't kill you. He'd love to. Maybe someday he'll try to. But right now there are other things I need to talk to you about. Gurney proceeded to bring Hardwick up to date on the events of the day, beginning with his conversations with Whittaker Coolidge and Corey Payne, and ending with his discovery of the possible switching of the flush handles. Hardwick grunted. That toilet thing sounds like a stretch. I agree. But if it's true, we're dealing with a goddamn elaborate setup. I agree. Shitload of planning. Yep. Big risk would suggest a big payoff. Right. So the questions would be, who done it and why? There's another interesting question. If Payne was framed, was that a tactic to divert blame, or was it the goal? The hell does that mean? Did the killer pick Payne as a convenient framing victim to misdirect the investigation into the cop killings, or were the cops killed for the explicit purpose of framing him? Jesus, don't you think that's a little twisted? Why the hell would framing him be important enough to kill two cops? I admit it's pushing the possibilities a bit. More than a fucking bit. I'd still like to know for sure which end is the dog and which end is the tail. In the meantime, how's your poking around in Beckert's past going? A couple of guys are supposed to be getting back to me. I should be able to tell you something later tonight. Or maybe not. Who knows how eager these cocksuckers are to return favors. 35. At 5 p.m., Gurney was heading up the hillside road to his property, weary from his obsessive analysis of scenarios involving the framing of Corey Payne. From the moment he'd noticed the plier marks where the outside flush handle joined the flushing mechanism inside the tank, he'd been able to think of little else. When he reached the end of the road, however, and came abreast of his barn, the subject was nudged aside by the presence of Walter Thrasher's sleek black Audi. Gurney remembered the phone call in which he'd agreed to let the man search for artifacts that might support whatever notion he'd gotten about the history of the place. He was tempted to go up to the excavation site to see if he'd found what he was looking for. But the prospect of trudging up the hill was discouraging, and he continued on to the house. Madeline, in her straw gardening hat, was kneeling at the edge of the asparagus bed, prying out weeds with a trowel. She looked up at him, tilting the brim of her hat to shield her eyes from the afternoon sun. "Are you all right?" she asked. "You look worn out."
"I feel worn out."
"Any progress?"
"Mostly uncovering new questions. We'll see where they lead."
She shrugged and went back to her weeding. "I assume you know about that man down by the pond?"
"Dr. Walter Thrasher, he asked me if he could poke around in our excavation."
"You mean your excavation?"
"Apparently he's an expert on the colonial history of this area."
He paused.
"He's also the county medical examiner."
"Is that so?"
She stabbed her trowel down around a dandelion root.
He watched for a while in silence before asking,
"How's Heather doing?"
"Last I heard, the contractions stopped, or what they thought were contractions. They're keeping her in the hospital for at least another 24 hours for evaluation."
She yanked a long root out of the ground and tossed it on a pile beside her. She gazed at the trowel for a moment, laid it on top of the weeds, and looked up at him again.
"You really do look like you had a difficult day."
"I did, but I have a recovery plan, a hot shower. I'll see you in a little while."
As usual, the shower worked at least some of its hoped-for magic. It struck him as an odd irony of the human animal that the most complex mental tangles could be relieved by the application of warm water. By the time they sat down to dinner, he felt calm and refreshed. He was even able to appreciate the scent of apple blossoms in the soft spring air coming in through the French doors. They were well into their asparagus soup before Madeline broke the silence.
"Do you want to tell me about your day?"
"It's a long story."
"I'm not going anywhere."
He began with his morning visit to St. Thomas the Apostle. He told her about the Reverend Coolidge's sympathy for the BDA and for Marcel Jordan's and Virgil Tooker's supposed efforts to expose police wrongdoing, about the man's almost violent aversion to Del Beckert, and about his insistence on the innocence of Corey Payne. He told her about his subsequent meeting with Payne himself, about Payne's explanation for his presence at the shooting sites, about his open contempt for his father, about his fear of being next in line for assassination. He also told her about his phone conversation with Thrasher, about the appearance of propofol in Jordan's and Tooker's tox screens, and about the chilling discovery made during the Rick Loomis autopsy. At Gurney's mention of the ice pick, Madeline uttered a guttural cry of revulsion.
"Are you saying that someone just walked into the ICU and did that?"
"It could have happened in the ICU or when he was being brought back from radiology."
"My God. How? I don't understand how someone could just..."
"It could have been a hospital employee, someone familiar to the nurses, or someone in uniform. Maybe a security person or someone pretending to be a doctor."
"Or a cop?"
"Or a cop. Someone who wanted to make sure Rick would never come out of that coma."
"When will Heather be told?"
"Not right away, I'm sure."
"Won't she automatically be given a copy of that autopsy report?"
"She'll have to request it, and the official version probably won't be available for another 30 days.
What Thrasher gave me on the phone was an oral heads-up on the preliminary report, which doesn't go to anyone except through the police, as an aid to the investigation. She started to take a spoonful of her soup, then laid the spoon down as though she'd lost her appetite and pushed the bowl toward the center of the table. After a while, Gurney went on with the story of his day. He talked about his visits to the two apartments, his discovery of the suspicious tool marks on the toilet handles, his growing sense that everything Del Beckert was saying about the case was either a mistake or a lie, and the unnerving possibility of police involvement in the shootings.
"That isn't exactly news," said Madeline.
"What do you mean?"
"Isn't that what the text on John Steele's phone said from the beginning?"
"The text didn't provide any real information. It could have been an intentional misdirection. It still could be. This case is like a buried city. We're only seeing pieces of it. I need more facts."
"You need to do something. Two women lost their husbands. An unborn baby lost her father. Something has to be done."
"What do you think I should be doing that I'm not doing already?"
"I don't know. You're good at assembling bits of information and seeing a pattern in them. But I think sometimes you enjoy the intellectual process so much you don't like to rush it."
He said nothing. His normal impulse to defend himself seemed to have gone missing. The list of hospital employees he'd gotten from Abby Marsh was divided into six functional categories: administration and technical support, physicians and surgeons, nursing and therapy, laboratory and pharmacy, security, maintenance, and housekeeping, kitchen, cafeteria, and gift shop. A seventh cross-functional category was labeled Current Year Resignations and Terminations. It was apparently updated monthly, covering January through the end of April, making it useless for identifying staff members who might have been terminated during the current month. Going through the six functional lists produced no instant revelations. He came upon several names familiar from his visits. He noted a predictable relationship between job description and home address. Most of the housekeeping staff lived in Grinton. The nursing, lab, and technical support people were more likely to live in Bluestone. Physicians and surgeons preferred Aston Lake and Kilburnie Heights. Although he was aware that the largest part of detective work involved slogging along unproductive paths, Madeline's comment had left him with a feeling of restlessness, an itch to accelerate the process. After considering some actionable next steps, he decided to pursue an answer to a question that intrigued him. If there was a reasonable doubt about the involvement of Corey Payne, then any possible aid provided to him by the Black Defense Alliance was equally questionable. But if the BDA was not involved in the planning or execution of the shootings, why had Marcel Jordan leased the two shooting sites? Or had he, in fact, even done so? The fact that his name appeared on the leases fell short of proving his involvement. The leasing brokers might be able to shed some light on the matter. Gurney placed a call to Torres to get the brokers' names. Torres responded without hesitation. "Laura Conway at Acme Realty. She's the broker for both locations. For most of the rental properties in White River. There are other brokers in town, but Acme manages almost all the rentals. We have a good relationship. Is there some way I can help?" "I want to find out about the lease agreements on the Bridge Street apartment and the Poulter Street house, specifically whether anyone at the realty company had direct contact with Marcel Jordan. If you want, I can ask about that for you. Or if you'd rather, I can have Laura Conway call you directly. The second option would be best. Depending on what she says about Jordan, I may have follow-up questions. I'll see if I can reach her now. Sometimes she works late. Let me get back to you." 5 minutes later, Torres called back. "Conway is on vacation up in the Maine woods. No cell phone, no internet, no email, but she should be back in the office in 3 or 4 days. Do you know if anyone else in the office was involved with those contracts?" "I asked. The answer was no. Laura handled both of them personally." "Okay, I appreciate the effort. You'll try again when she's due back?" "Absolutely."
He hesitated.
"You think there's something wrong with the contracts?" "I'd like to know whether Jordan himself personally leased those places. By the way, you mentioned the department has a good relationship with Acme. What sort of good relationship?"
"Just good."
"Mark, you're not a particularly good liar."
Torres hesitated.
"I have to testify at a trial in Albany tomorrow morning. I need to be there by 10. I could stop off in Walnut Crossing around 8. Could we meet someplace and talk?
There's a place for coffee and dillweed. It's called Abelard's, on the county road in the center of the village. I can be there at 8. I'll see you then.
Gurney knew if he gave in to the inclination to speculate, he'd waste a lot of time trying to arrive at an answer that would likely be handed to him the following morning. Instead, he placed a call to Jack Hardwick. It went to voicemail, and he left a message.
Gurney here. I'm getting some ugly ideas about this case, and I need you to tell me what's wrong with them. I'm going to be at Abelard's tomorrow morning to meet with a young detective. He has to get to Albany for a trial, and he'll need to be on his way by 8:30. If you can come then, that would be ideal.
36.
When Gurney pulled into the tiny parking area in front of Abelard's at 7:55 a.m., the Crown Vic was already there. He found Torres at one of the rickety antique tables in the back. Every time he saw the young detective, he looked a little younger and a little more lost. His shoulders were hunched, and he was holding his coffee mug in both hands as if he were trying to give them something to do. Gurney sat opposite him.
"I remember this place when I was a little kid," said Torres. His voice conveyed the special tension produced by trying to sound relaxed. "Back then it was a dusty old general store, used to sell live bait for fishing before it got all fixed up."
"You grew up in Dillweed?"
"No, out in Binghamton. But I had an aunt and uncle here. They immigrated from Puerto Rico about 10 years before my parents and I came up. They had a small dairy farm. Compared to Binghamton, this was real country. The area hasn't changed much. Mostly got poorer, more run down. But this place sure got fixed up."
He paused, lowering his voice.
"Have you heard about the latest problem in the search for the Gorts?"
"What now?"
"That second canine dog they brought in, it got a crossbow arrow through its head just like the first. And the state police helicopter had to make an emergency landing in one of the old quarries. Some kind of mechanical problem. Just the kind of mess the media loves and Beckert hates."
Gurney said nothing.
He was waiting for Torres to get to the real point of their meeting. He ordered a double espresso for Marika, whose spiked hair that morning was only one color, a relatively conservative silver blonde. Torres took a deep breath.
"Sorry about dragging you out here like this. We probably could have talked on the phone, but..."
He shook his head.
"I guess I'm getting kind of paranoid."
"I know the feeling."
Torres's eyes widened.
"You? You seem unshakable."
"Sometimes I am, sometimes I'm not."
Torres bit his lower lip. He seemed to be steeling himself for a dive off the high board.
"You asked about Acme Realty. About Acme's relationship with the department.
The way I understand it, it's kind of a reciprocal arrangement."
"Meaning what?"
"Well, rental management can be a tough business in some neighborhoods. Not just trying to collect rent from deadbeats, but nastier stuff. Dealers turning the property into a crack house. Illegal activity that can void the owner's insurance. Tenants threatening to kill landlords. Gangbangers scaring decent tenants away. Apartments getting trashed. You're a landlord in a tough area like Grinton. You're going to be dealing with some dangerously crazy tenants."
"So what's the reciprocal arrangement?"
"Acme gets the support it needs from the department. Gangbangers, drug dealers, and crazies are persuaded to move on. People who don't pay their rent are persuaded to do so."
"What does the department get in return?"
"Access."
"Access to what?"
"To any rental unit Acme manages."
"The Poulter Street house?"
"Yes."
"The Bridge Street apartment?"
"Yes."
"Corey Payne's apartment?"
"Yes."
Marika arrived with his espresso.
"God," she said. "You boys look super serious. Whatever you do for a living, I'm glad I don't do it. You want sugar with that?"
Gurney shook his head. When she was gone, he said, "So we're talking about warrantless searches."
Torres said nothing, just nodded.
"So let's say you have a vague suspicion there might be some illegal activity in a particular apartment, but nothing concrete. And you know that no one is home during the day, so what then? You call up that Conway woman and ask her for a key?"
Torres looked around nervously.
"No. You go to Turlock."
"And he calls Conway?"
"I don't know. I just know he's the one you'd go to, and he'd supply the key."
"So you take the key. You check out the premises, you see the evidence you guessed might be there, then what?"
"You leave everything like it was, you get a warrant from Judge Puckett,
specifying what you expect to find, claiming it was based on reliable tips from two sources. Then you go back and find it. All neat and legal.
You've done this?
No, I'm not comfortable with it. But I know some guys have.
And they have no problem with it?
They don't seem to. It's blessed from the top. That means a lot.
Gurney couldn't disagree with that.
So the bad guys get put away or run out of town. Acme has fewer problems, and their business is more profitable. Meanwhile, Beckert gets credit for reducing the population of undesirables and cleaning up White River. He becomes a champion of law and order. Everybody wins.
Torres nodded.
That's pretty much the way it works.
Okay. Big question. Do you know of situations where evidence was planted by the same officer who later found it?
Torres was staring down into the coffee mug he was still grasping with both hands.
I couldn't say for sure. All I know is what I'm telling you.
But you're uncomfortable with all that illegal access?
I guess so. Maybe I'm in the wrong line of work.
Law enforcement?
The reality of it. The version you learn in the academy is fine, but it's a whole other thing out on the street. It's like you have to break the law to uphold it.
He was gripping his mug so tightly now his knuckles were white.
I mean, what's due process anyway? Is that supposed to be a real thing? Or do we just pretend it's a real thing? Are we supposed to respect it even when it's inconvenient, or only when it doesn't get in the way of what we want to achieve?
Where do you think Del Beckert stands on that question?
Beckert is all about the result, the final product, period.
And how he gets there doesn't matter?
It sure doesn't seem to. It's like there's no standard other than what that man wants.
He sighed and met Gurney's gaze.
You think maybe I should be in another profession?
Why do you ask?
Because I hate the conflicts that are part of the job.
Part of the job? Part of this peculiar case? Part of working in a racially divided city? Or just part of working for Beckert?
Maybe all of those.
Plus, being a Latino in a very Anglo department can get a little tense. Sometimes more than a little.
Let me ask you something. Why did you become a cop to begin with?
To be helpful, make a difference, do the right thing?
And you don't think that's what you're doing?
I'm trying, but I feel like I'm in a minefield. Take this situation with the toilet handle. I mean, if pain is being set up by someone in the department?
His voice trailed off. He looked down at his watch.
Christ, I better get going.
Gurney walked out with him to the parking area. Torres opened his car door, but didn't immediately get in. He uttered a small, humorless laugh.
I just said in there that I wanted to be helpful, but I don't have a clue how to do that. It seems that the longer this case goes on, the less I know.
That's not the worst thing in the world. Realizing you have no idea what's going on is a hell of a lot better than being totally sure about everything, and totally wrong.
37. 3 minutes later, as Torres's Crown Victoria was pulling out onto the county road, Hardwick's growling red GTO was pulling in. Hardwick got out and swung the heavy door shut with the crashing thump that only vintage Detroit cars make. He cast a sideways glance at the departing sedan.
"Where's the Dick and the Vic?"
"Mark Torres," said Gurney, CIO on the Steele and Loomis cases.
"Just the shootings? Who caught the playground murders?"
"He did, for about 10 minutes. Then Beckert took over and handed them off to Turlock." Hardwick shrugged.
"Like it's always been. Del calls the shots, the turd does the work."
Gurney led the way back inside to the table he'd occupied with Torres. Marika came over and Gurney ordered another double espresso. Hardwick ordered a large mug of Abelard's special dark roast.
"What did you learn about Beckert?" Gurney asked.
"Here's what I was told. Mostly second-hand stuff. Rumors. Bullshit. Some of it might be partly true. No telling which part."
"You inspire confidence."
"Confidence is my middle name. So, here's the story. Del is a shortened form of Cordell. Specifically Cordell Beckert II, known to some of his associates as CB2, meaning there was another Cordell Beckert somewhere in the family tree. Corey Payne was actually christened Cordell Beckert III. Del was born in Utica 46 years ago. His father was a cop, disabled in a shootout with a drug dealer, quadriplegic, died when Del was 10. After grammar school, I already told you some of this, Dell got a scholarship to a military prep school in the redneck end of Virginia, Bayard Whitson Academy, where he met Judd Turlock, and where Judd had his juvie legal problem. I'll come back to that in a minute. After Bayard Whitson, he went to... Gurney interrupted. It's interesting that Beckert never used what happened to his father as a credential for his war on drugs like he did with his wife's death. Hardwick shrugged. Maybe he didn't give a shit about the old man. Or the opposite. Some people never mention the things that affect them the most. Marika arrived at the table with Hardwick's coffee, then left. When she was out of earshot, he continued. After Bayard Whitson, Dell went to Choke Christian College, where he met and married his first wife, Melissa Payne. Corey was born right after he graduated from Choke's ROTC program. He joined the Marines as a lieutenant, completed a 4-year tour, came out as a captain, then joined the NYSP. With his Marine officer background, he moved up quickly during the next 7 or 8 years. The job was first, family distant second. Along the way, Melissa fell in love with painkillers, and Corey became a festering thorn in his side, which I told you about. Culminating in the attempted torching of the recruiting office? Right. But there's something else I was just told by someone who knew the family back then. But it might be total bullshit. See, to do you a fucking favor, I've been making a giant pain in the ass of myself, calling people I haven't spoken to in years, annoying them with one goddamn question after another. They may be making up crap to get rid of me. You love making a giant pain in the ass of yourself. What did you find out? 2-3 months before Dad finally sent the little bastard away to the boot camp boarding school prison, whatever the fuck you want to call it, Corey supposedly had a druggy girlfriend. He was a large, aggressive 12. She was maybe 14 and dealing a little pot here and there. Dell had her picked up and tossed into juvie detention for possession and intent to make a point to Corey about what happens when you hang out with people Dad doesn't approve of. Problem is, she was raped in the detention center, supposedly by a couple of COs, and hanged herself, or so the story goes. Anyway, it was after that that Corey went totally batshit and got sent away to the discipline farm. No blowback on Beckert from the kid's death? Not even a breeze. Gurney nodded thoughtfully, sipping his espresso. So he puts his son's girlfriend in a place where she gets raped and ends up dead, and when the kid reacts, he sticks him in some behavior mod hellhole. His desperate addict wife either accidentally or not so accidentally ODs on heroin, and he uses that to sanctify his image as a determined drug fighter. Fast forward to the present. 2 White River cops get killed, he's handed some shaky evidence that his son may have been involved, and he appears on one of the most popular interview shows in the country to announce not only that he's ordered his son's arrest for murder, but that he's sacrificing his outstanding police career in the interest of justice. You know something, Jack? This guy makes me want to throw up. The challenging look that was never completely absent from Hardwick's eyes sharpened. You don't like him because you think he's accepting shaky evidence against his own son as gospel? Or is it the other way around? You're seeing the evidence as shaky because you don't like him? I don't think I'm being delusional. It's a simple fact that all the so-called evidence is portable. None of it was found on the interior doors, walls, windows, or any other structural parts of those premises. Doesn't that strike you as peculiar? Peculiar shit happens all the time. The world is a factory for peculiar shit. One more point. Torres just told me that Turlock has a deal with the rental agent that would have given him easy access to the locations where the so-called evidence was found. Wait a minute. If you're suggesting that Turlock planted that evidence, you're really suggesting it was Beckert, since the turd does nothing without a nod from God. The toilet handle switch indicates that somebody planted it with the intention of incriminating Corey Payne. There's no other reasonable interpretation of that. All I'm saying about Turlock and Beckert is that their involvement is possible. Hardwick made his acid reflux face. I'll admit Beckert is a prick, but to frame his own son for murder, what kind of person does that? Gurney shrugged. A blindly ambitious psychopath? But why? Even psychopaths need motives. Makes no fucking sense. And it's a hell of a shakier premise than Corey being the shooter. Take that weird flush-handled thing out of the equation and your whole framing theory collapses. Couldn't you be mistaken about the significance of those tool scratches? It's too big a coincidence for both those handles to have been removed and replaced, with one of them providing a key fingerprint in a murder investigation.
Hardwick shook his head.
Look at it from the motive angle. Look at what we know about Corey Payne. Radical, unstable, full of rage, hates his father, hates cops, has a long history of public rants against law enforcement. One of his favorite lines is the BDA motto, "The problem isn't cop killers, it's killer cops." I was listening to one of his speeches on YouTube. He was talking about the moral duty of the oppressed to take an eye for an eye, which is essentially invoking the Bible to advocate the murder of police officers. And that business about his girlfriend being raped by a couple of COs? Can't you see that festering in his mind? Shit, Gurney, he sounds to me like a prime suspect for exactly what he's being accused of. And there's just one problem with it. He might have all the motivation in the world, but he's not an idiot. He wouldn't leave brass casings with his prints on them at the shooting sites. He wouldn't leave a Band-Aid floating in the toilet with his DNA on it. He wouldn't drive an easily traceable car with visible plates past a series of traffic cameras and park it next to each shooting location unless he were doing it for some other reason. It's not like he wanted to be caught or to claim responsibility for the shootings. He's adamantly denying any involvement. And there's the problem of victim selection. Why would he pick the two cops in the department who were the least like the cops he supposedly hates? Logically and emotionally, none of it makes sense. Hardwick turned up his palms in exasperation. You think Beckert framing his own son makes logical and emotional sense? Why the hell would he do that? And by the way, do what exactly? I mean, are you suggesting Beckert framed his own son for two murders someone else committed? Or are you saying that Beckert also arranged the murders of two of his own cops, plus the BDA murders? You seriously believe all that? What I believe is that the people he's blaming for it had nothing to do with it. The Gorts? Why not? The Gorts are violent, uneducated, redneck racists, men whose approach to life involves skulls, crossbows, pit bulls, and chopping up dead bears for dog food. So what? The playground murders were carefully planned and executed. They required knowledge of the victim's movements, a flawless double kidnapping, and the sophisticated administration of propofol. And Thrasher told me the tox screens on the victims included not only propofol but alcohol and benzodiazepines. That suggests a scenario that began with a friendly meeting over a few drinks, something I can't imagine occurring between the BDA leaders and the Gorts. What about the evidence they keep talking about on TV? The rope they found in the Gorts compound and the computer drive with the KRS website elements on it. And both could have been as easily planted as the items they're trying to hang Corey with. Christ, if we had to exclude every piece of evidence that could have been planted, no one would ever be convicted of anything. Gurney said nothing. Hardwick stared at him. This fixation you have on Beckert, what's that really based on, besides his crazy son blaming him for everything? It's just a feeling at this point, which is why I want to find out everything I can about the man's history. A few minutes ago, you alluded to Turlock's juvie legal problem when he was in school with Beckert. Were you able to find out anything more about that? Hardwick paused. When he finally spoke, his tone had become less argumentative. Maybe something, maybe nothing. I called the Bayard-Whitson Academy and got the headmaster's assistant. I told her I was interested in speaking with any staff members who'd been at the school 30 years ago. She wanted to know why. I said that one of their eminent graduates, Del Beckert, who was a student at that time, could be the next New York State Attorney General. That I was writing an article about him for a journalism course I was taking, and I'd love to be able to include the perspective of any of his teachers who might be willing to share an anecdote or two. She bought this? She did. In fact, after a little more back and forth, she told me that she had been there herself, as assistant to the previous headmaster, when Beckert was a student. She say anything about him? Yep. Cold, calculating, clever, ambitious, was awarded top cadet distinction in every one of his 4 years there. He must have made a big impression on her for it to last 30 years. And Judd Turlock apparently made a bigger one. When I mentioned his name, there was total silence. I thought the call was cut off. She finally said she had no desire to talk about Turlock because in all her time at Bayard, he was the only student who'd made her feel uneasy. I asked her if she knew of any trouble he'd gotten into, and there was another dead silence. Then she told me to hang on a minute. When she came back to the phone, she gave me an address in Pennsylvania. She said it belonged to a detective by the name of Merle Tabor. Said if anyone could tell me anything about the incident involving Turlock, it would be Merle.
The incident? She didn't say anything specific about that?
No. My mention of Turlock pretty much shut her down. Seemed like after she gave me that address, she just wanted to get off the phone.
Quite a reaction after 30 years.
Hardwick picked up his coffee mug and took a long swallow.
There's something unnerving about the turd. He tends to stick in the mind.
Interesting.
You plan to follow up with Merle Tabor?
Hell no. According to the school lady, Merle's an off-the-grid kind of guy. No phone, no email, no computer, no electricity. You can pay him a visit and find out for yourself if the spirit moves you. Probably no more than a 4-hour trip, assuming you don't get lost in the woods.
Hardwick pulled a scrap of notepaper out of his pocket and slid it across the table. There was an address of sorts, scrawled on it in his nearly indecipherable handwriting. Black Mountain Hollow, Parkston, PA.
Who knows, a couple of old retired farts like you might hit it off. Merle could end up handing you the key to the whole goddamn mess.
It was clear from his tone that he considered such an outcome unlikely. Gurney saw no reason to disagree. 38. After Hardwick roared off in his eco-hostel muscle car, Gurney stayed at Abelard's for a little while to finish his coffee and organize the rest of his day. Merle Tabor had suddenly become the elephant in the room, and despite Gurney's mixed feelings about the usefulness of a visit to Black Mountain Hollow, he found it impossible to dismiss. He took out his phone and went to a Google satellite view of Parkston, Pennsylvania. There wasn't much to see. The place appeared to be a crossroads in the middle of nowhere. He typed in Black Mountain Hollow and discovered that it was a narrow dirt road proceeding from a county route 3 miles up into the hills. There was one house on it at the very end. He clicked on directions, entered his Walnut Crossing address as the starting point, and found that the distance to Parkston was 142 miles. The estimated drive time was just under 3 hours, not Hardwick's 4. Even so, he was reluctant to make the trip without some indication that Merle Tabor would be there. He looked up the number for the Parkston Police Department. His call was automatically transferred to the county sheriff's office. He assumed he must have misheard the name given by the man who answered, Sergeant Gerbil, but he didn't question it. He explained that he was a retired NYPD homicide detective, had been hired to look into an old case down in Buttrose County, Virginia, and had reason to believe that a Parkston resident by the name of Merle Tabor might be able to give him some useful information. But he didn't know how to get in touch with the man. He was starting to explain that Tabor lived on Black Mountain Hollow and had no phone when the sergeant interrupted him with a nasal Appalachian accent.
You planning on paying him a visit?
Yes, but I'd like to know that he's there before I drive for three.
He's there.
Excuse me?
He's always there in the spring of the year, most other times, too.
You know him?
Somewhat, but it don't sound like you do.
I don't. His name was given to me as someone familiar with the case I'm looking into. Is there any way of getting in touch with him?
You want to see him, you just have to go see him.
His house at the end of Hollow Road?
Only house up there.
Okay, thank you.
Your name again?
Dave Gurney.
NYPD?
Homicide, retired.
Good luck. By the way, make sure it's daylight.
Daylight?
Merle don't like people on his property after dark.
After ending the call, Gurney checked the time. It was just 9:05. If he left immediately, allowing 6 hours for the total round-trip drive time, plus 45 minutes with Merle Tabor, he could be home before 4. He had some phone calls to make, but he could make them en route. He paid Morica for the coffees, left a generous tip, and set out for Parkston. As he was heading southwest through the Long River Valley toward Pennsylvania, he made the first call, to Madeline. They went to her voicemail. He left a detailed message explaining where he was going and why. Then he checked his own voicemail and discovered that she'd left a message for him since he'd had his phone shut off all morning. He played it back.
Hi, I just arrived at the clinic. I don't know if that Thrasher person was there when you were leaving for Abelard's this morning, but when I was leaving at 8:40, I saw his fancy car down by our barn. I don't like the idea of him coming up on our property whenever he feels like it. In fact, I don't like him being there at all. We need to talk. Soon. See you later. Aside from feeling the automatic negative reaction he felt whenever Madeline raised a problem, he had to admit he wasn't especially pleased with Thrasher's presence either, and he certainly wasn't pleased with the man's secretiveness about what he was looking for. His next call was to Torres, to raise a point he'd meant to bring up at Abelard's before he was distracted by the young detective's slide into self-doubt. He got his voicemail. "Mark, it's Dave Gurney. I want to suggest something. If Corey Payne wasn't the shooter at the Bridge Street apartment building, obviously someone else was. You need to take another look at the traffic and security videos. The shooter may have used that red motocross bike, or another vehicle, even a police car. If the pattern from Poulter Street is repeated, he may have tried to stick to side streets to avoid being caught on camera. He may even have walked most, or all of the way, but there are a hell of a lot more cameras in that part of town than around Poulter Street. And I'd be willing to bet he ended up within range of at least one of them. Unless you actually recognize a vehicle you know, you'll have to go by the timing, looking for vehicles that enter and then leave the area at times consistent with the shooting. It'll be a time-consuming job, but it could break the case. His next call, as he crossed a modest bridge over the headwaters of the Delaware River into Pennsylvania, was to the Episcopal Rector in White River. The man's greeting was so smoothly delivered that Gurney thought for a second he'd reached another voicemail recording. "Good morning, this is Whitaker Coolidge at St. Thomas the Apostle. How can I help you?" "This is Dave Gurney." "Dave, I was just thinking about you. Any encouraging news?" "Some progress, but I'm calling with a question." "Fire away." "It's for Corey, actually, unless you happen to know the answer. I need to know if he's ever owned any .30-06 rifle cartridges." "Didn't you raise that point when you were here?" "I said that the police found a box of cartridges in his closet, and—" Coolidge cut him off. "And he denied it, vehemently." "I know. This is a different question. I want to know if he's ever owned any, or maybe just had a few in his possession, maybe holding them for someone else, maybe just for a day." "I seriously doubt it. He hates guns." "I understand, but I still need to know if he's ever had any sort of contact with any .30-06 cartridges, and if so, what the circumstances were. Would you pass the question along to him?" "I will." There was an edge of annoyance in Coolidge's cultured voice. "I'm just giving you a preview of the likely answer." Gurney forced himself to smile. He'd read somewhere that speaking through a smiling mouth made one sound friendlier, and he wanted to maintain the rector's goodwill. "I really appreciate your help with this, Whit. Corey's answer could make a big difference in the case." He was tempted to add that the time factor was crucial, but he didn't want to push his luck. In fact, adding that note of urgency turned out to be unnecessary. Less than 5 minutes later, he received a call from Payne. His tone was brusque. "I'm not sure I understand your question. I thought I explained that I don't have a gun. You're still asking if I have bullets?"
"Or if you ever did, .30-06s.
"I've never owned a gun. I've never owned bullets of any kind."
"Have you ever had any in your possession? Perhaps storing them for someone else, or buying them and passing them along, possibly as a favor for someone?"
"I've never done anything like that. Why?"
"Two cartridge casings were found with your fingerprints on them."
"That's impossible."
"I've been told the prints are of good quality."
"I said it's impossible. I don't own a gun. I don't own bullets. I've never bought bullets, kept bullets in my apartment, or held bullets for anyone, period. End of story."
The words came racing out, his voice brittle with anger. "Then there must be another explanation."
"Obviously."
"Okay, Corey. You think about it. I'll think about it. Maybe we'll figure it out." Payne said nothing. Gurney ended the call. A minute later, his phone rang. It was Payne.
"I thought of something that happened 2-3 months ago." He was still speaking rapidly, but the anger was gone. "My father was having one of his brief human periods. We were—"
"Human periods?"
Every once in a while he'd act like a normal person, actually talk to me. It would only last a day, if even that, then he'd go back to being God.
Okay, sorry I interrupted what you were starting to say.
So the time I'm talking about we had lunch, we managed to get through our burgers without him telling me what a waste I was, then we drove out to his cabin. You know what reloading is?
You're referring to custom-making ammunition?
Exactly. He's a gun fanatic, him and Turlock. In fact, they share that cabin for hunting.
Why did he take you there?
His idea of a father-son thing? He said he wanted me to help him do some reloading like it was a privilege, allowing me into the world of guns and hunting, murdering animals. So he's got this contraption that funnels gunpowder into the brass part and the thing that pushes the bullet part in. He's got this intense look like he loves doing this. How crazy is that?
He wanted you to help him.
He had some little boxes to put the reloaded ones in. He had me doing that.
So you were handling those cartridges?
Putting them in boxes? I didn't think of it at first. When you were asking about having bullets in my possession, I didn't think of it that way.
You know if they were 30-06s?
I have no idea.
You say this happened 2 or 3 months ago.
Something like that. And you know what? Now that I think of it, that was the last time I saw him, until I saw him calling me a murderer on TV.
Where were you living at the time?
The apartment I still have. I heard the asshole cops tore it apart.
How long have you lived there?
A little over 3 years.
How did you find it?
When I first came to White River, I stayed at my father's house for a couple of months. I started taking computer science courses at the community college in Larverton, and I got a job at that computer repair shop in town. There was an apartment for rent upstairs in that same building. Living with my father and his sickening bitch of a wife wasn't working, so I took the apartment. How does any of this matter?
Gurney ignored the question. You've been there ever since?
Yes.
Ever try going back to your father's house?
No. I stayed over a few times. I could never stay more than one night. I'd rather sleep in the street.
As Payne was speaking, Gurney slowed down and pulled into a gas station. He parked by the seedy-looking convenience store in back of the pumps.
I have another question for you. How did you meet Blaze?
Payne hesitated.
I met her through her half-brother, Darwin. He owns the computer business where I work.
Why are we talking about Blaze?
She's prominent in the Black Defense Alliance. The case against you involves your connection to that, and she lent you the car you drove to the shooting sites.
I told you the case against me is bullshit, and I explained why I went to those places.
What kind of a relationship do you have with her?
Sex. Fun. Kind of an on-and-off thing. Nothing serious. No commitments.
He found it hard to imagine this tense, sharp-edged, angry young man having fun.
How did she feel about Marcel Jordan and Virgil Tooker?
She didn't talk about them.
Gurney made a mental note to probe that further, then changed the subject.
Do you know anything about the legal difficulty Judd Turlock got into when he and your father were teenagers in school together?
There was a moment of silence.
What difficulty?
You have no idea what I'm talking about?
Another moment of silence.
I'm not sure. I think there was something that happened, but I don't know what it was. I haven't thought about this for years.
Haven't thought about what?
When I was a kid, when they were both still with the state police, they were talking one night in the den about some judge down in Virginia. Some judge who'd taken care of something for Judd years earlier, something that could have been a huge problem. When they saw me at the door, they stopped talking. I remember it felt weird, like I wasn't supposed to have heard them. I guess whatever it was must have happened when they were in school, because I know the school was in Virginia. But I don't know if that's the same thing you're talking about.
Neither do I. And by the way, where did you have lunch?
Lunch?
With your father, the day he took you to his cabin.
A place by the strip mall. I think it's a McDonald's or Burger King. Why?
The more facts I have, the better.
After Gurney ended the call, he went into the convenience store. The place had a sour smell of old pizza and burned coffee. The register clerk was a tall, gaunt, vacant-eyed 20-something male covered with a lacework of arcane tattoos.
He had the rotten teeth that came with the use of methamphetamine, rural drug of choice prior to the tidal wave of heroin. Gurney bought a bottle of water, took it out to the car, and sat there for a while, pondering what Payne had told him. It was actually quite a lot. But perhaps most important was the possible explanation of how his fingerprints might have gotten on the brass casings found at both shooting sites, as well as on the fast food wrapper in the Bridge Street apartment. And if the casings and wrapper did in fact come from Payne's day with his father, then Del Beckert must have been involved in the framing scheme. It was a scenario that seemed to increase in ugliness, the more likely it became. 39. As Gurney drove southwest through a progression of black cherry copses and open pastures, he was haunted by the empty stare of the convenience store clerk and what it suggested about the rotting underside of rural life in America. The problems, of course, weren't just rural. Urban areas were often dirtier and more dangerous to live in. But here, the contrast between the verdant beauty of the landscape and the gray hopelessness of so many of the inhabitants was jarring. Worst of all, in an age of vicious polarization, there seemed to be no acceptable way of addressing the problem. Add a few layers of racial animosity, cultural resentment, and political grandstanding, and solutions seemed far out of reach. As he was sinking into the edgy depression these thoughts generated, his phone rang. "Private caller" was all the ID screen revealed. "Gurney here."
"Dave, so glad I got you. This is Trish Gelter."
"Trish, hello." The first image of her that came to mind was that last glimpse he had caught of her, a memorable rear view of her progress across the room in her slinky dress at the fundraising party for the animal shelter. "This is a surprise. How are you?"
"That depends."
"Depends on what?"
"On how soon I can see you."
"See me?"
"I heard a rumor you were working on that terrible shooting case."
"Who did you hear that from?"
"I was afraid you'd ask that. I'm terrible with names. Is it true?"
"More or less. Why?"
"I thought the police had it all wrapped up."
Gurney said nothing.
"But you don't think so?"
"I'm not sure yet what to think." He paused. "Is there something you wanted to tell me?"
"Yes, but not on the phone."
"But not on the phone." He wondered for a moment who else had used that phrase, then remembered it was Rick Loomis when he suggested they meet at the Larvitan Diner, the meeting he was headed to when he was shot. "How, then?"
"Face to face."
She made it sound like her favorite sex position. He hesitated. "It's not something you can tell me now?"
"It's too complicated." She sounded pouty. "And I'd really like to see you."
Again, he hesitated. "Where would you like to meet?"
"It would have to be here. I'm marooned. My Porsche is in the shop, and Marv took the Ferrari out to the Hamptons for a couple of days."
When he didn't answer immediately, she added,
"I know Lochinberry is out of your way, but I really feel it's urgent."
The combination of her missing husband and urgent was distracting.
"How soon can you come?" she asked.
He thought about it, from multiple angles, some more distracting than others, which made him wonder if he was making the right decision for the right reason. "I'm down in Pennsylvania right now for a meeting, maybe late this afternoon or early evening."
"Either way is good. I'll be here. It'll be really nice to see you again."
The call from Trish Gelter pushed aside Gurney's musing over the social and economic desolation of the rural Northeast and replaced it with a specific, vivid recollection from the Gelter fundraiser. Trish coming over to Marv to let him know that Del Beckert was on the phone, and Marv leaving the party immediately to take the call. He had wondered then what sort of relationship might exist between Gelter and Beckert, and that same question returned now with additional force. As he considered the possibilities, his GPS guided him into an even remoter area in which the houses were increasingly far apart. Eventually, it announced that he had arrived at his destination, the foot of the road that led to Merle Tabor's house. Black Mountain Hollow Road was, for all practical purposes, unmarked. Its identifying sign had been used for target practice.
The letters that were partly legible among the rust-edged bullet holes could make sense only if you already knew the words they were part of. The road was narrow, twisty, rutted, and full of rocks and deep puddles. Once it began climbing the higher ground, there were no more puddles, but the rocks, ruts, and sharp turns persisted. At 3 miles in, according to Gurney's odometer, this rough dirt track emerged from the scrubby forest that had